again. I'm Terry Thornton. I'm curator of education here at The Modern, and it's my honor to welcome you to Tuesday evenings at The Modern, our weekly lecture series. We're coming to an end, so I hope you've been able to take advantage of some of our earlier lectures this fall. I have to say, it's one of my favorite lineups. I'm not saying individual lectures necessarily, but lineups in all my years here. Next week, we will take a break so as not to conflict with voting. But the following week, on Tuesday, November 9th, artist Spencer Finch will be here to share what I think is his absolutely stunning work, perfect combination of beauty and brains. The work has been described as employing a scientific method to achieve poetic ends, and I think that's a very apt description. The work that was seen in Daniel Birnbaum's exhibition Making Worlds for the 53rd Venice Biennale. Also work currently on view at the Corcoran Gallery of Art and the exhibition Spencer Finch, My Business with the Clouds. So I invite you back on the 9th, November 9th. And actually, that will be our last Tuesday evening lecture for the fall series. Very sad, but Uta Bart, I had mentioned before, had to reschedule. So she's going to be our first lecture on February, I think, 8th it is, when the winter-spring series begins. So Spencer Finch on the 9th will be our last lecture for the fall series, and I really encourage you to come back and bring one friend, because I don't think we have room for more than one, okay? If everybody comes back and brings one. In addition to the call of the voting booth next Tuesday, there's Halloween this coming Sunday, and no one wants to mess with Halloween. So we are also taking a break from our weekly Sundays with the Modern tours that we've been doing. But we resume in a very big way with Dr. Malcolm Warner, the Deputy Director of the Kimball, who will be here to give his insights into the work of Vernon Fisher in our special exhibition, Vernon Fisher, Kmart Conceptualism. And I know that brings us to tonight's presentation, but before introducing our guest, I would like to alert you to the programming for this exhibition, which has truly been an absolute pleasure to introduce to our museum audiences, thanks to the breadth and depth of Vernon Fisher's work. I won't run through every program, but I want to encourage you to visit the Modern's website, where you will find a variety of opportunities on the exhibition microsite, which is you can easily access by clicking on the website's front page on the image of the exhibition. There you will find a great video interview between the artist and the curator, Michael Opping, which takes place in the artist's studio. Two film suggestions by the artist, one of which has already played, but one of which you can still catch. And they are free and, of course, are shown here in this auditorium. A very interesting short story writing project, which is available to all, anybody who has any aspirations of writing or already is a writer. I welcome your submissions to that. Also, podcast tours and much more. So check it out and pass it on if you would. Okay, now for the reason that we are here. I can't tell you what a pleasure it is to introduce these two people. They really are very special to me for who they are and for what they bring to this community. Dr. Francis Colbert, the Rose Chair of Art History in the School of Art at TCU, and artist Vernon Fisher are here to discuss, to present the issues at stake in Vernon's work of the past 30 years as found in the beautiful monograph, which I hope you were able to get in our bookstore tonight and have signed, Vernon Fisher, which was recently published by UT Press. It has a very thoughtful and scholarly essay by Fran Colbert, an introduction by Ned Rifkin, and an interview between Vernon Fisher and Michael Opping, the Modern's chief curator, and as mentioned, curator of this exhibition, of the exhibition that's upstairs, which is, I have to say, also the impetus for tonight's lecture. Francis Colbert's credentials are more than notable as a nationally recognized scholar of 20th century and contemporary art, an art historian, critic, and author of many books and essays on contemporary art, including Minimalism, the Critical Perspective, which is considered a seminal text on the movement of minimalism. She is also a corresponding editor for Art in America, in addition to regularly writing for other publications. And she occasionally finds the time to curate with a number of interesting exhibitions under her belt, including the upcoming exhibition, Skin Freak, showing the work of Edith Bauman, Darcy Hubler, Aaron Perizet, and John Pomara at the Fort Worth Contemporary of TCU, which opens on November the 13th. Vernon Fisher has also been duly acknowledged for his profound contributions, with a distinguished international exhibition record including more than 80 solo exhibitions, work in multiple Whitney biennial exhibitions, and pieces in the permanent collections of more than 40 distinguished museums as well as significant private collections. Vernon has received no less than 3 NEA grants, a Guggenheim Fellowship, a Lewis Comfort Tiffany Foundation Award, and a Distinguished Teaching of Art Award from the College Art Association, which I am mentioning for the former students of Vernon who are here tonight and who know how worthy he is of such recognition. This is no doubt a dynamic duo, and tonight's presentation grows out of a dialogue that has been developed between the two through conversations and studio visits since 2008. We are fortunate that they have agreed to share their findings and conclusions with us tonight. So would you please join me in welcoming Vernon Fisher and Fran Kolbeck.
Okay, now, is that better? Thanks, Michael. Thanks, John. Sorry. So let's see. One of the reasons that we've had, I think, our dialogue has been sort of interesting is, this just occurred to me during Terry's introduction, is because Vernon's work has been associated with narrative art, and he tells stories in his work, and most of my work has been on abstraction and minimal art, so we probably couldn't have two more different backgrounds coming together, and perhaps that's why we've enjoyed our dialogue. So I thought we won't move through the whole evening chronologically, but I wanted to start in the 70s and or even late 60s and just have Vernon talk a little bit about his background and particularly the significance of literature and how literature provides a methodology for his construction of narratives in his paintings. And this has remained consistent, I think, from the beginning, from the late 70s to the present. Vernon was an undergraduate literature major and only became interested in making art towards the end of his undergraduate career, I guess that's called a career, his undergraduate studies, when he shifted to the studio area from literature and then went on, of course, did his MFA in painting. But there are two things, two processes that he holds over, I think, or carries into the visual world from the literary world, two ways of making work. One is to use as a model metaphysical poetry, and there's a discussion of that in my essay in the book. And then the second is this process that I didn't know anything about that Vernon introduced to me a while ago that he calls the metonymic slide. So I wonder if you could talk a little bit about how these two literary ideas, the metonym and the metaphysics or and metaphysical poetry, give you a kind of firm provide a methodology for making your work.
Well, I'd just like to start off saying that I think these questions are really unfair.
He even asked me to show him the questions for
because she gets to write all this down, and I don't know what they are. And the metaphysical poetry describes poets like John Donne, and what you see is and it's sort of an extended comparison between things that are essentially very unlike. If you were to, in say a romantic or sentimental poem, you might have the comparison of love to a sunset, something like that. Something you would think would be an appropriate comparison. My love is a red, red rose, that kind of business. But in John Donne, you'll have comparisons between love and, say, a compass, you know, an instrument, a drawing instrument. And not only will this comparison be made, but it'll be extended through several, several couplets or quatrains or whatever. And you see a little bit of that in the early 20th century poets like Eliot, who were very interested in the metaphysical poets and essentially revived interest in people like John Donne with their own poetry, which is something that you see in art all the time, too. Like Duchamp became more interesting after Jasper Johns started making paintings mm-hmm. that essentially said, what would a painting look like if it were ready-made? It's the same kind of thing. Mm-hmm. And so you have Eliot saying something like, let us go then, you and I, when the evening is spread out against the sky like a patient etherized upon a table. So that's a comparison between, you know, it's a kind of startling comparison that you're going to get there. In my own work, the way I use that, if I use that, is that when I think of things in a painting or a piece relating, I think of it as like current running through a wire. If you snip the wire, and the two ends of the wire are still near each other, you'll get a little spark. And there's that place where you can get the wires further and further apart where you get a longer and longer spark. If you go too far, of course, you get no spark. And what I'm looking for is the longest spark I can get. So when I started making the narrative paintings, I was really very concerned that the parts would relate. You know, that like if I wrote a story, I would want to, that typically the visual part of it could be a setting. Okay, so you at least it would be a plausible kind of relationship. And then I went through a whole period where I did a lot of conceptual things, where the story out of the story would come kind of an ending that would reflect something that had gone on with the story, like looking for a baseball cap, and then at the end, you know, the character has a shoe on his head instead of the baseball cap, but he's got a baseball uniform on, and the baseball uniform was constructed to go with the story.
So the shoe on his head substitutes for the baseball hat.
In this particular
in the way
story,
that the
because
the etherized patient substitutes for the
jokier
okay.
way.
Okay.
And later on, though, I got insight that you didn't have to be too careful when you did this. At first, I was thinking that you did, that you had to make these things relate. So the first story I wrote was called Smoke, and it's about a person out in. Actually, all the person is doing is watching a fire smolder and watching the smoke drift up into the sky. And he's talking, he's thinking about his life. And it's although it's written in the third person, it's closely associated with the character's thoughts, which is, I think, technically called free indirect is the technique. And what he's basically doing, what one is led to do as you look at the piece is make a connection between, what the character is doing. The character is watching the smoke. What we're doing is making a connection between what his mind is doing and what we're seeing and experiencing poetically as the smoke drifts aimlessly into the sky, okay? So I was trying to get that stuff to go together. Later, after reading the Julian James book I was telling you about, I discovered that you didn't have to get them too close together. I mean, if you put two things together, you're set up to try to figure it out. And if I hold something in each hand like this, you know, the first thing you're going to think is you're going to be making a comparison. You know, what are these things there? And that's what I depend on the viewer to do. You know. What was the other question?
Well, the
Was that?
Yeah, that was the answer.
Probably. Yeah. Okay. Do I get
you get an A. One of the, I guess, that, and I hadn't actually thought about it that way before, but that connection is what the author he's referring to, Julian Jaynes, talks about as narratizing. When two things happen, and a narrative always has to have two things, two people or two events or two. You can't have a narrative if there's only one person or one book or one whatever. So when James talks about narratizing, he talks about the fact that your mind forces you to invent a story to accommodate whatever these two things are. So Vernon discovers that, right? That viewers will do that, and then you can pull your as you say, the ends of the wire farther and farther apart, and the viewer will want to make the story him or herself, and we can't help but want to do that. The problem is you never get those damn wires back together in Vernon's work. They won't ever come back. No matter how much there's that spark arcing, they won't. There's no taper.
Which some people find irritating.
Yeah, it's very frustrating.
But you know the thing, and I will, in defense of myself, you don't find that irritating when you read a book. You only find it irritating in art because the tradition in literature is a tradition that embraces ambiguity, whereas the tradition in art is about clarity.
Yeah.
You didn't know that, did you?
I did not know that. That's very interesting. Now, the second thing I wanted to ask you, keeping with the topic of literature just for a minute, was the process of the metonymic slide. And that was especially clear to me when you talked about that with the graph paper pieces, because it has discrete, the ones that are on simulated graph paper, there are discrete images. Do you think we should get one of those up?
Once you show that painting, yeah.
Let's see, that would be number 17. So we're gonna start the slides. I've got about 20 slides here, and they are arranged chronologically, but we thought it would be better just to flip back and forth. So as something comes up, since this is totally not planned, this discussion is not planned at all. This is disconsolate pairs from the graph paper series from 2008. And this is the series that Vernon used to talk to me about the process of using a metonymic kind of comparison to decide which images should be included in this seemingly random selection, I almost want to say array, of appropriated images.
Well, you're supposed to tell him what metonymy is first, though, right?
Oh, okay.
No, I'll do it.
Okay. You can do it or I'll do it.
Okay, I'll do it. metonymy is a literary trope where what you're doing is making a substitution for, usually it's a part for the whole, like I see the king's hand in this. Or you're using...
The crown standing for the king.
The hand standing for the power of the king.
Right.
I see the king's intentions. The hand stands for the king's intentions. Or it could be something closely associated with something. For example, the White House announced today.
Right.
That kind of thing. Well, we're talking about the administration. So that's the way that works. Now, it occurred to me that that's also the way our mind works. You know, in other words, literary tropes they're not artificial. They're not something you study in school that someone invented to harass you during your studies. They're actually a reflection of the way your mind naturally wants to put things together. And so I had been reading, I mean, I've always thought about, not always, but I've occasionally dipped into Buddhism, reading things about Zen and so forth. And in doing that, I discovered that I have very little patience and I have no aptitude for this. In other words, like I tried to meditate today because I was real nervous before coming here. And you know how you're supposed to do that and become really quiet and you're supposed to just think of this one thought over and over, concentrate on your breathing or you say your mantra? The longest I've ever been able to meditate is less than a minute. You know, I'm a complete failure at that. So one day I was reading an article about Buddhism and they mentioned this concept called monkey mind. And this is something you're trying to escape when you meditate. And what monkey mind is that your thoughts just jump all over the place from limb to limb, just like nervous. And I said, I can go with that. You know, just turn it into a positive. It's like if you have a tragic day, you turn it, you know what I mean? It's good material. Mm-hmm. So the way I would start these paintings, I made a graph paper facsimile with a vinyl cutter. And then my notion was I would paint something. And then I would let the something suggest something else. So the first image I painted here, I think, was the character in the middle, which is a character from the early version of Gun Crazy. And I liked it. I was shooting a lot of stills from film noir, and I painted that. And then the next thing I painted was Marlon Brando up on the left. That's from Streetcar. And at this point, I forgot, maybe I painted, that's from, there's where the names go, Paul Newman and who's the other guy on the left there? From Asphalt Jungle. Anyway, I know his name, I can't remember it. But anyway, and then I paired a couple of guys up, and then I had this image of Mickey. I drew an image of Mickey looking like Marlon Brando. And from then, I got the title, Disconsolate Pairs. And so then I made all these pairs of that are disconsolate. So I got Laurie Anderson and Nancy both holding cigarettes, like so. I've got Nancy and Sluggo down at the bottom. Then I've got Ignatz and Mickey there on the right. And so it's just a series of, you know, disconsolate pairs. But I made probably a dozen of those paintings or more, and they always work the same way. You do one thing, and then let your mind just whatever association comes up. So they're not predictable, really.
But it's an interesting process. It's an improvisational process.
It is.
That you use, and you have to depend on it. You have to be confident that it's going to work.
Well, no.
But you're also depending on the viewer
connection. That's the thing I liked about it. It doesn't have to work. You know, if you're going to do an improvisational cubist painting, you've already got an armature with which you're going to improvise. Uh-huh. It's like doing jazz. You're going to hang on to the wire that's the melody, and then you're going to do variations on that, okay? Or if you're going to do an all-over painting like Pollock, he starts off. He's going to improvise as he goes, you know what I mean?
So it's surefire then?
It's surefire in the sense that if you build the intentions of failure or irresolution into the work to begin with, you're not going
to... There's no way to
You know,
lose.
There's no way to, yeah. You know, either right. You're going to get on board with it or you're not. But once you, in my thinking, once you had the graph paper,
right.
You know, that presents itself as a place where one has expectations of one working something out, mm-hmm. like planning stuff, okay? Well, at what point is the plan done? Plans are often abandoned. So this is why a lot of these paintings toward the bottom of the thing would be like, you know, sort of drift away and fade away because I wouldn't wouldn't carry it that much mm-hmm. further. Yeah. Mm-hmm. I mean, there's no structure here of like that's got any sense of necessity to it.
Mm-hmm. Just one more kind of literary question here, thinking back to your foundation in studying literature. You must have been reading literary criticism as well as practicing writing and creative writing and those sorts of things, because there's obviously two areas in English departments. One is creative and the other one is more critical, right? And it occurred to me that maybe you should have been studying at the time that you were in college the new criticism in literary terms, which had started, when did that start, 50s, 40s maybe? 40s or 50s, which was essentially, for those of you who aren't familiar with the new criticism, the literary approach to criticism that began mid-century, is really parallel to what we call formalism in visual art. And it was revolutionary for literary critics to look at form and structure more than meaning, in the way that Clement Greenberg looks at form and structure rather than content in talking about visual arts. So that would have, I would have thought that would have been what you would have learned, but in school, and you may have, what it seems to me your work is more similar to in terms of a critical theory or critical method is structuralism and even post-structuralism and the analyses or criticism of Roland Barthes, for example. So what was your thinking about structuralism or Roland Barthes and formalism? Or new criticism? None?
Can you believe this shit?
just wanted to talk about growing up in Granbury?
No, but going back to the new criticism, before we're going to go into structuralism, post-structuralism, we should go back to new criticism.
Okay.
Because you got it really wrong. And if you were to repeat what you said wrong, I could have corrected that for you. But what the new critics did was to put the emphasis on the work itself in so far as you understood the meaning. The meaning resided in the poem, not in biography. Mm-hmm. That's really what it was about. It wasn't about going back and trying to retrieve historical,
intentions. Like, they weren't looking at intentions.
They weren't looking at intentions. Well, except so much as the intentions become implicit in the work. I mean, that's a truism almost, that mm-hmm. with any successful work of art, the intentions have to be not explicit, meaning you don't say what you're up to, but they're implicit in the sense that they're bound into the work in such a way as that intentionality doesn't come up. If it comes up, then you've already failed, or someone's failed. In my case, I always think that it's the audience that failed. You know? Because they're clearly not, sophisticated enough, sensitive enough. In fact, when we were doing the book, that was my biggest problem with you most of the time.
What was that?
Just insensitive to the work. But
I had a different interpretation than you did.
You did indeed. I've never had a narrative painting turned upside down before. No, and then the other thing was about Roland Barthes.
Right? Yeah,
And you're talking about the writerly text and the readerly text.
Yeah.
And I forget which one's which, but basically it's a critique of Victorian writing is what I think it is, Barthes is. When he's talking about, I forget which it is, the readerly or the writerly, but you can make that straight for him. But there's a certain kind of fiction that existed in a moment where you could make assertions about the nature of morality, reality, and all that business, and you'd know everybody'd be on board with it. For example, you could make a comment about, well, women are like so-and-so, or you could imply that women are so-and-so, and everybody would be on board with that because everybody had a shared understanding of what was real, okay? And what you see with, it's the writerly text that Barthes is valorizing,
right.
Is you have a kind of text that sort of deconstructs itself and that is more open-ended and requires participation on the part of the viewer. And also in the writing of the text, it is not able to formulate any kind of truisms or any kind of universal truths. I mean, what you get is a text that requires interpretation. Well, the coming out of literature where all you did was interpret stuff, like if you study literature, that's what you do. Like, well, what does proof rock mean? What does it mean when this, blah, blah, blah. And what does it mean when he says an intended lord? Well, you're supposed to know that's Rosencrantz and Guildenstern, okay? That kind of business. So you do that kind of retrieval, especially with Eliot, where you have all these, references to earlier, and especially Elizabethan poetry. So when I made paintings, I fantasized, I guess, that somebody would spend some time thinking about it. So I guess I made paintings like you might make a literary text with the thought that somebody might actually read it as mm-hmm. opposed to just have it wash over you. Okay. Mm-hmm. And the difference between you and I, which we discovered in talking to each other, I mean, it was a very odd pairing, you'd have to admit, because I'm out of literature, and you're a formalist. Mm-hmm. You really like you like a lot of people that I don't like that much.
I
like them okay.
Person.
It's just that I don't want to spend my time.
Yeah. Well, you're trying to correct me about my understanding of new criticism, but let me say this then. There are two approaches to both literature and visual art, and the new critics, according to your just the interpretation you just gave, the new critics don't bring extraneous information into, say, letters the artist wrote explaining what the book was about, right? That they're just focused on the work itself. In your work, we can't do that. I mean, obviously your work is not formalist, but to understand your work, we do have to bring in a whole lot of outside knowledge. That, yes, we do. We have to know who Marlon Brando is, and we have to know who's...
But, just to correct you on this big mistake you're making, when you read a work of literature, you're supposed to have read stuff. Readers are supposed to be literate, okay? That's no different than when you see a Nolan, you know,
right.
It's that Rosalind Krauss thing.
That's a good
when you
point.
Look at, when she says, when I see the Nolan, what I see is history all the way back to Manet, a series of rooms, with each room having a problem to be solved, inevitably leading to the next room. That's an inevitable kind of art historical historicism, mm-hmm. you know, it's teleological. And to say that you have to retrieve information, I expect that people look at stuff that they've read, that they've seen movies, and so forth. That's no different than looking at a Renaissance painting and say, oh, well, look at that plant, or the blue. You know, or I'll tell you a better example. Here's a picture painted in the Renaissance, and there's a man with wings on his back approaching this woman. Now, what the hell does that mean? You know, unless you know about the Annunciation, unless you know that stuff, you don't get that painting.
Right.
You know, from another culture, you wouldn't get that painting. And if you look at anything, everything has context. You can't understand anything without context.
So there's no real difference between formalism and what you're doing?
Well, you need to tell me what formalism is, because I think the mistakes that the formalists made was to pretend that you could have form without content. Okay? I mean, we know better than that now. But when you read... This is why I used to hate to read criticism in like art form and stuff. I would read it, and I never knew what the hell they were talking about. I mean, I understood the words, but they would say things, and I felt like, you know what? I'm just not. I felt just like I was in church back when I used to sit in the Baptist church, and the preacher would say all this stuff, and he'd say, you've got to repent, you've got to do this, and you've got to do that, and if you do all this, you'll be saved. And I would sit there and say, you know, I'm doomed, because I could never understand it, what they were talking about. And I'd read this formalist stuff, and I could never understand what they were talking about. You know, like when, Susan Sontag says that if you talk about content, that you're being a Philistine. You know, I mean, what? You know, I mean, what's the point then? You know, if it doesn't have content, then what is it? If it's just decoration or what? You see what I'm saying?
Yeah.
So, yeah.
I mean, just in defense, I won't go there any farther, but
go
in
ahead,
defense
go for
of the
it.
In defense of sort of Greenbergian formalism, which got really perverted later on.
Yeah.
Greenberg said that he certainly believed in content, and content was the purpose of a work of art, but it wasn't able to be. Content was in a painting, for example, could not be verbalized. It was not language-based content, so he never wrote about it. Other people did say, I've read certainly lots of critics from the 60s who said things like, the form is the content, or there is no content outside of the form. That was a common thing for people to say.
But there's a distinction to be made here. It's one thing to say you can talk about it, and it's another thing to claim that words can be substituted for it. That's a big difference. If you have a poem and you do a summary of, or a, what is it? What is the word when you paraphrase of a poem? Mm-hmm. A paraphrase of a poem is not the poem. The only way you get the poem is with the poem. So, but to say that you can't talk about it, that you can't point at it, you know. If you read the, for one thing, you have a lot of these formalist paintings. Formalist painters making a lot of remarks about their work in words, you know, trying to guide us in the way that we're going to go, you know. So it's all there.
Don't you think poetry is easier to talk about, though, in words?
No, I don't.
You don't?
I don't. I think they're equally difficult to talk about, because talking about it's okay, but what people get accused of trying to do, which you're not trying to do, is to provide a substitute, a linguistic substitute for it. No one argues that you can do that. Okay? But you can talk about it. If you couldn't talk about it, you would not have a job.
But I never feel like I'm getting it in language. Do you know? It's not the same thing as looking at an artwork.
Yeah,
and having the experience
exactly.
of an artwork. You
and
can never make,
same
like you said,
way
the
with the same way with the literary form. The same way with the musical form, which, of course, is the most radical, you know? You hear the music, you feel the music, and what... You can't make a substitute for the music. I think I talk about something that must be
right.
really hard to write about. You're talking about things like sonority. You know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
I mean,
yeah.
How do you do that? Yeah. I mean, it's all this is very, very difficult, but people still try to do it because, for one thing, they want to evaluate it. Okay? They want to make distinctions between what's worth spending some time on and what's not worth spending some time on. They want to help others understand what they love, so they write an essay like you write an essay, and you champion someone, and what you do is you try to express what it is that, even though you can't, you say, you admit, you know, but that kind of goes without saying.
Well, you do. You write around it, and you talk around it.
And you point at it from different directions
right.
and so forth, yeah.
I think... Besides the sort of specific process that's used for this kind of work, that to jump back for a minute now to the earlier work, that 84 Sparrows, which this we're lucky to have in Fort Worth, it's owned by the Modern, 84 Sparrows is really the breakthrough work. And there are other shifts that occur in your long career, but this seems to me to be the one really where you become what I would call a mature artist. That is, you're not done in 1984, whenever, when was that, 81?
79.
You're not finished, obviously, but this is the point where we begin to see an artist who's working on his own, right? That you're really working with your own ideas, or you develop a set of ideas that will sort of feed the work. So let me run back to 84 Sparrows. Do you mind talking about that for a minute?
No, go ahead. I mean, sure.
Oops, there we go.
That's it.
Those birds are bigger. Those are bigger birds.
That's an interesting statement.
Well, I've been looking at the original slide all these years. And
mm-hmm. Well, when you say the birds are bigger, are you talking about the individual birds
yes.
being larger?
The individual birds.
Are you talking
birds,
about the array of birds being larger?
I was talking about each individual bird. It looks bird size. And in the original version, they're smaller than birds. They're like tweeties. They're like parakeets. And now they're like... cardinals.
Same birds.
Wow. They grew, I guess. We're saying this because he made new birds for the installation at this museum.
No, I didn't make new birds. I rearranged the birds in a larger array.
They're not new birds?
They're not new
they
birds.
They look bigger. Okay.
Well, they're not bigger.
Okay. The array is bigger?
There are more birds.
Okay.
When this was first installed, it was at the old museum in a place that had low ceilings, that sort of hallway area.
Right.
So when I put up the birds and then the crew that's going to re-put it, you know, reinstall it at various times, they make a pattern so they can put it up. And now it was going to be put in a different place with walls that are 14 feet high in that particular location. And so I needed to make the birds kind of like go up a little, so I did. And I put more birds. But these are the same birds that were at the old museum.
Oh, they are?
Yeah.
So there's no new birds in it. They're all, they were just out of the box. They were.
That's correct.
Okay.
Yeah.
Sorry. They look bigger.
Well.
Maybe the photographer's closer than he was in 1978. Okay, I'm sorry. but I'm glad you explained that. So could you talk a little bit about maybe what came first here? Did the birds come first, or the camper come first, or the story on the camper?
Okay. Originally, this piece evolves out of an earlier piece called Lecture on Photography, which was a piece I made in 77, which had two components, both pictures of the camper, one a photograph and one a drawing. Through the photograph, I sent it a story that I wrote that was basically a parody of art criticism that you would typically see in art forum. You know, I would use words like historicism, teleological, decisive moment, and stuff like that. And actually, I ended up, because of that, I ended up with a show at the Center for Creative Photography because this guy said it's the best definition of photography he's ever read.
That's great.
It's true. And I had to give a lecture there, and I did not mention that it was satirical. But anyway, that was written in, you know, in that kind of cold-blooded art form 1970s style. And then I thought what I would, and that was through the photograph. And when I printed the photograph, I also showed the latent edge of the photograph, so you knew that was all you were going to get, so you had that documentary feel. This is before Photoshop and stuff, when photographs did have a certain kind of authority built into them because it was a mechanical process. Then the right part was going to be a drawing of from the photograph, and then this story is the story that ended up here, and it was written in the first person, and it was a somewhat emotional kind of moment, okay? It's a death scene, essentially. So this was going to be the comparison. So this is, in an instance, the point of view becoming very, very important, you know? So I later on, I said I wanted to make that bigger. This was just a small piece, so I wanted to make it bigger. So I printed up the I printed up the camper as a photograph, and then I did the drawing, and I sanded it through, and then I said, you know what, I'm going to turn this, I wanted to turn it into a piece by itself, split the piece up. And so I did, and at that point I cast around for things, and I had a whole collection of Nancy comic strips that, you know, that I was cutting out of the paper for a couple of years. And I looked through there, and I found this image of bar soap landing in a bowl of fudge that Aunt Fritzie's making. And I was completely unaware at this time that the shape of the camper, the arc that the top of the camper makes in that space, mimics pretty much that arc of the soap flying through the air.
Once you know where the soap comes from, it makes more sense. You want to tell them where the soap came from?
Through the window.
Oh, like every day. Come on. It makes you feel better once you know where the soap came from.
Where did the
Because soap doesn't normally fly in the kitchen window.
Somebody's given free samples. Right. I don't know. I mean, you know, it's like one of those things you stumble on. And, I mean, it doesn't...
Doesn't it make you feel better to know that the soap came from a kid throwing free samples?
But you don't know that.
No?
All you know is something's coming through the window and you don't even know it's soap. Really? Or does it say soap?
You don't even know it's soap.
I don't think you do.
Would be interesting to talk to somebody about this who didn't know it was soap coming through the window from a kid throwing free samples.
It doesn't make any difference.
It doesn't.
I don't think so.
Really?
No. The other day, I was watching Boardwalk Empire. Julie's going to hate me because I spent about 5 hours talking to her about this one scene in this. Are you watching Boardwalk Empire? You know, the HBO series? And there's this scene, you know, where the scene where the pro kills herself, you know, she's gotten her face slashed, and this guy that's been living with her, she says, kiss me. And so he kisses her, and as he kisses her, she wants to prolong the kiss, and he doesn't. And so she's reading that she's being rejected because of this scar that she's, you know, this horrible scar that she's got. And so he kind of pulls away, and he goes into the other room to wash out a stain that he's gotten from wine, I believe, that he's dropped on his shirt. He goes into the other room. First thing we see is a middle distance shot where he's framed by the doorway. He's at the sink. We hear the noise, and we see him scrubbing the stain out. Then there's a close-up suddenly of him really working on this stain. Then there's even a closer close-up of water coming out this faucet. And you hear the sound of this water coming out this faucet, And then the camera backs up, or it's actually just a cut, and then you see him from behind over his shoulder, kind of looking in the mirror, and then you hear the gunshot. Okay? What's the faucet? What's that mean?
Does it matter?
That's my point.
Oh. So, but you weren't worried enough to talk to Julie for 5 hours about the faucet?
No, I was insane about the faucet. I thought it was just so cool. I spent the next day trying to figure out what all the hell all that meant and what it stood for and how it worked. And I was totally caught up in it, you know. And I think that's the way that stuff happens in movies all the time, you know. Guy says goodbye to this other person. She goes to the door, and he rolls up the window because they've been talking through the window, and it's raining. He rolls up the window, and the camera stops, and there's rain on the window for a second. You don't need that. That does not add anything to the narrative, but it adds something to the movie, okay? Mm-hmm. And if you read novels, there's always a good novel will always have a surplus of detail. I'm not talking about building a novel out of detail where you just have an abundance of detail and this convinces you that what you're reading is real. I'm talking about in spare, mm-hmm. pared down novels, you still want a surplus.
Anymore.
Thank you. Of detail, because you have to have some throwaway stuff to convince you that it's not just all, you know, planned out and manipulated, because then you're going to feel manipulated and you're not going to go for it. You're not going to believe it, okay? Which is one of my arguments with formalism, is because they're making it so pure that you don't have the contamination that makes it seem like, to me, like life.
It isn't like life.
It isn't like life, and what it is a dream about, it's a dream about eternity that we wish to believe in, is what I mm-hmm. think. Mm-hmm. Anyway, back to this. Mm-hmm. After I had this, well, if I got this thing on the right, then it's not working, and I need something on the left. And I made two or three things. The first thing I made was some kind of spiral thing that I cut out of canvas. I mean, I made a bunch of different things. And finally, I stumbled on the idea of making the birds, and I made the birds. And the first time I arranged the birds, I arranged them in a rectangle about the same size as the central panel. And then I numbered all the birds, one through however many there were, and there were 84. I made a template so I could put it up like that. And then I never put it up like that again, because it occurred to me the second time it occurred to me that was unnecessary to do it that way. It would be better just to have the birds kind of splashed on the wall.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So they reiterate the splash of the fudge.
Sort of. But yeah. Then they're put on in some kind of random thing where they kind of work like a Larry Poons painting.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
Remember those lines?
Where there's an implied grid underneath.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. So the cubist grid's still kind of hiding in there. Yeah.
You just said something interesting when you were talking about writing the story, which is... I'll try to summarize it. It ends with a boy on a merry-go-round, or it starts with a boy on a merry-go-round, but one of the most potent images in the story, which is on the central panel etched into the camper image, is the narrator's talking in the first person about blood running down his sleeve and dripping on his shoes and bouncing off the rocks or something. And that's a very visual image. And then, of course, that you look at the next panel on the right and see the fudge dripping, and it's really interestingly in terms of form and content tied together. Another thing that you told me once when I was writing, and you were correcting me for this book, I was talking about another story. I was writing about another story about a boy learning to read. His mother was reading a story to him, and it's in the panel, the work that matches Elf, I think, or that was at the Hirshhorn underneath Elf. And there's a story of a boy, is he watching television or thinking about television? I'm thinking about the one about the Tarzan movies on TV. And I said, I'd written this this paragraph about this particular narrative, and I said something like, Fisher reveals his love of Tarzan as a child. And Vernon said, I didn't say anything about my love of childhood, but it was written in the first person, and we're so tempted. I thought that was brilliant. A brilliant correction, really, because
I did, Fran. I thought that was a brilliant correction.
It really was. I think we're all tempted when you use the first person, and you know what you're doing, but we're tempted to think it's you. Blood's dripping down the sleeve.
In literature, it's actually called the intentional fallacy.
Well,
you know, the pathetic fallacy, which is to imbue nature with, to personify
that's the
nature.
Pathetic fallacy, right.
But it's the intentional fallacy. Just because you read it, but you know, you can't assume that Hemingway is Lieutenant Henry.
Mm-hmm.
You know.
But it's a temptation, and you're aware of the viewer being tempted, obviously, to read
only the unsophisticated
these
viewer.
as your own interest in Tarzan movies.
But you know, that's a tradition that comes out of art, not out of literature.
Hmm.
Okay, because we're all familiar with Van Gogh, and that I don't know if that's where it starts, but Van Gogh is certainly where it gains a lot of impetus, and that is that we look at Van Gogh through Van Gogh's suicide and his cutting off of his ear. So every painting we look at, we think, oh my God, that poor bastard.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
That he could make such a joy. Even with the joyful paintings, we think,
right. Oh,
you know, look at that bravery to paint that painting.
But that I think that myth, you know, I've been studying that sort of myth of self-expression for a while, and it certainly goes back to Van Gogh. I think he's the central figure, but you can trace it to Rembrandt, even, and Delacroix. But it has now become, and it shouldn't be in the 21st century, but it has become, through, I think, abstract expressionism primarily, the central myth about painting, that it is expressive of the artist's self. And so many people can't separate. I mean, it's harder for me in literature. I'm always reading when it's in the first person. I'm always thinking, well, the author is saying this. The author is saying this, or the speaker is saying this. But it's also assumed in all painting, isn't it? That works, especially painting works of art, are self-expressive.
Yeah, there's always the assumption of the autobiography beneath the surface. Yeah.
Okay, you were associated in the first sort of big decade of your career, the 1980s, both with narrative art, which was more, I think, a national movement. I mean, there was more narrative art in outside of New York City. There was narrative art in New York, too, but it was a style of art called narrative art in the late 70s and 80s, but also with conceptual art. And in my mind, those two movements could not be farther apart, other than the fact that many narrative artists use language. But they're very, very different. They happened at the same time, conceptual art and narrative art, but they're very different.
Yeah.
Do you have somebody said, you can be in a narrative art show or you can be in a conceptual art show. Would you feel closer to one or the other?
Well, since narrative art really didn't go anywhere, I think I'd rather be a conceptual artist. So.
Good answer.
But I think, you know, if you just to make a point about art, how art history works, you know, like when Saul LeWitt, who may be one of the first conceptual artists, you know, he's the guy who actually said the idea becomes the machine that makes the art. So he would write something up that then would be determine the parameters of the art object that would emerge out of that, especially the wall drawings. But if you look at his sculpture, especially, that sculpture could have been made by a mentalist. So he's writing something up, but then what he writes up ends up with what came before anyway. Okay? Well, if you apply that analogy to conceptual art and narrative art, what you have are conceptualists writing this sort of dry text. And you can go into, I forget where Joseph Kosciusz showed. Was it Sonnenblend or...
Well, he shows it Sean Kelly now.
No, but where he showed
Castelli.
When he started out. Was it Castelli?
Oh, well, he started out with Seth Siegelob.
Okay.
Who had a conceptual
gallery. Shouldn't have asked that question because you know too much. But wherever, you know, 420 West Broadway, one of those floors.
Okay, Sonnenblend, I think.
Sonnenblend, you could go in and there's a reading room. And you go in and there's all this, you know, and what your art experience is very much like going to school. And because all you have are these tables laid out with all these books that you can read. And
was that the eighth investigation with the clocks on the wall and you read the notebooks and they told you to look at the wall?
I don't even think there were clocks on the wall.
Really?
I think it was just, it could have been. Yeah. But anyway, it was not entertaining. And with narrative art, what you get is you get flavor. You get that, but you get flavor. You still have the work, at least participating in how the work's going to end up looking, but you get kind of color and flavor. And it's, if I'm going to stand up and I'm going to read something standing up, I want some entertainment value.
That's a
value,
good point, I can't say that conceptual art is entertaining in that way. Can I ask one more question, Terry? Do I have time? It's 8 now. I have about 100, no, I have about 10 questions I didn't get to, we didn't get to all the slides. I am very impressed with this exhibition and the recreation of the installations, the works with the painting on the wall, and the text on the wall, and the scale, how you've altered the scale, even as you did with 84 birds, but you've altered the scale, let me find Colin, to fit the museum space as opposed to a lot of these works were originally shown in smaller galleries. And scale is a relational term. It's not the same as size, which is a constant. A scale is determined by the body, by your body, either the viewer's body and the artist's body, which are usually not all that much different. And Vernon, I thought Vernon knows this museum better than probably any artist does. He's been here a long time, and he's been in this building so many times. So obviously it's going to come easier to him than it would to an outsider who hadn't been here. But also it made me think of the fact that one thing that's very important in my experience of work is scale and is the body as the site of perception. And I really am absolutely committed to embodied perception. And I never even talked to you about that before. Mm-hmm. We've never really talked much about the role of the viewer's body in the work. Do you have anything to say about it?
Do I have anything to say about it? indirectly, kind of, yeah. I've never thought about it like that, But way back with Julian Jaynes and that book that we discussed this summer about narrativity, or was it two summers, whenever, there is this notion that the metaphors that we use to express ourselves and to understand the world do derive from our experience of the experience of our body in the world. For example, oh, I see what you're talking about. Well, we just use a visual metaphor for substitute for understanding. So, in that sense, I think you're absolutely right. I just never went that far with my own thought about it. Yeah.
So you're not conscious of, you're obviously conscious of scale. This is much larger than it was when you first installed it, Boat Island Ape.
But as an artist, you don't think that way.
You don't know.
I mean, you act that way, but you don't think that way.
Huh.
And that's the difference. In other words, you go in and you say, this has got to be bigger. But yeah. You don't formulate, you don't think, well, how big is it going to be? What you do is you play with it until it feels big enough.
So it's intuitive rather than consciously
articulated. Yeah, anything we do, I think, that's worth it doing is unconscious.
Yeah. Okay.
No, think about it. I mean, how much is 6 and 4? You don't compute that. You just know that. When you drive a car, you don't think. When you shoot a basketball, when you shoot pool, when you make sentences, I don't know what I'm going to say until I say it. You see the words coming out of your mouth, and then you know what you've just said. But you don't think all that and then say it. You know what I mean? You don't do that. Mm-hmm. It's all unconscious. The only time that you become conscious is when you become self-conscious. And then when you are self-conscious, this is when you fuck up. This is when you're conscious of being in front of an audience, or you're shooting a basket and it's the All-Star game, mm-hmm. or, that kind of thing.
Mm-hmm. Okay, should we ask for questions, you think? Okay, I'm trying to keep with the clock here.
But Terry took up 10 minutes of our time.
That just flew by. I'm sorry, I didn't get very far with the, with all my hard questions. But you passed. If I have a question. Thank you, that's really nice. Do you, anybody have a question they want to ask Vernon?
Wait. Does anyone have a question that you'd like to ask Fran?
I see a hand there.
Yeah, there's one sort of literary mechanism that neither of you mentioned at all, which I was a bit surprised about. And when I heard you speak on Sunday, Vernon, you talked about narratives in terms of sequential reading. You know, that you obviously want to read something in a certain order. Certainly the novel, you know, when we're talking about narrative, you think of this sort of novel from the 19th century onwards, I suppose. But if you go back to Shakespeare, especially, it's steeped in irony, the idea of tragic irony and the idea that you already know what's going to happen before it happens. And but a lot of what you just ended on was talking about, you came back to that idea of improvisation, the barking of sheep, not knowing what you're going to say until you say it. Whereas irony is obviously somewhat calculated, in a sense.
I'm sorry, I missed that word. Did you say irony is...
Irony is
calculated.
Somewhat calculated.
Yeah.
And so my question is irony, you know, most art works on the principle of ironic distance, and these days at least. And I wonder whether that's a component that is in the work that you never talk about deliberately. And also, if you perceive a difference between European irony and American irony, and if so, what is that? Because I can't work it out. But I think there is a difference.
I'm glad that you asked Fran this question. I can answer part of it, I think, and that is that irony may be an attitude that you carry with you that finds expression naturally as opposed to calculated. First, I would make that argument. Unless you're using dramatic irony in a horror movie, you know, where the fun of watching a horror movie is figuring out who's going to get killed by what they say. Oh, we'll go in this room, we'll be safe. And then, you know, okay, they're gone. illicit teenage lovers, they're dead. So forth.
You know, Eve Klein is with the making a flamethrower painting. That's an ironic artwork.
Making a claim for what?
A flamethrower painting.
Eve Klein. Flame.
Eve Klein.
Making the fire paint.
Yeah, that's pretty ironic, I think.
It is, but I don't think he intended it ironically.
Oh, he did.
Eve Klein.
Oh, Eve Klein. Yeah.
You just had the Second World War, and he's standing there with a flamethrower in a suit, burning a hole in the painting. Is about as ironic as you're going to get. Chris Burden.
Why would that be ironic?
Well, European irony, you see. I'm not sure it registers in America. I'm not sure. Jackson Pollock was not ironic. William de Kooning was. And I think that the differences are kind of quite subtle and the deeply embedded culturally. And whenever I ask an American about irony, I get an entirely different understanding of what I think it is. So, and that's why I'm seeing kind of a lot of irony in your work, but no one talked about it at all. But I'm wondering if I'm talking about something different.
Well,
you talked about a satirical mechanism and stuff like that. We're trying
yeah,
to do, but
yeah,
it's different. It's quite different.
Let's define irony. First, I think, let's say, irony is saying one thing while meaning another with the understanding that whoever you're addressing will understand that you're doing that. That's irony.
I know, that's American irony.
That's American irony.
That's
what I would argue then, that's American irony, and then European irony doesn't exist.
Predicated on things that are just on very deeply embedded cultural ideas. So if you've been bombed to shit by the Nazis and you used to have an empire, every single action you make becomes quite ironic. So when you were talking about the idea that you're an important
person. Okay, what I think you're talking about then is an irony that emerges out of a context.
Yeah.
And Europe is going to have a very different context because they went through. In fact, the whole continent has been ravaged by wars through generations and generations. So, one can depend upon the culture at large having an understanding of that as a background to anything that's said.
Absolutely. Which brings me back to what you were talking about, that you would hope that people understand the references in your, a lot of which are quite American.
Exactly.
References.
Yeah. No, I can see what you mean now. Yeah.
That was kind of the question.
Yeah.
That makes sense now that you've explained it. It does.
No,
because
it makes sense now that I've explained
the that you've explained. Obviously, the images from World War II, and there's so many images. I thought I had the one with the ship, battleships in it. I don't have it, the battleship and the plane sinking. But there are lots of images from World War II. We didn't even talk about the archive, your archive was where all the images are. But they have a certain read that's very true. That's, Hollywood triumphant is the World War II read of an image, an appropriated image in this country.
I mean, pretty hard to make an image of a nuclear explosion, sincerely, do you know what I mean? Because... Or Richter couldn't make the painting of the Twin Towers falling because what did that mean? It couldn't be anything but flippant after the tragedy.
Well, it's like Murakami making a reference to an atomic bomb in his work. Okay, and all you have to do is know where he's from, and then you understand it's going to be a whole different read. And that's essentially what you're talking about, the European irony.
Yeah.
So there's a Japanese version of, at least regarding that subject, there's a definite context that's different than ours.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
Can you talk about that?
Oh, this piece is called Boat Island Ape, and it's a piece of concrete poetry, in a sense, in that the words are objectified, okay? I mean, they're torn out of the wall. I thought the title was important because it's sort of like if you were presenting an idea to a Hollywood mogul to make a film, you'd say, oh, this is a fish out of water idea. Or in this case, just think, boat, island, ape. It's like a quick summary of the
comic. Like a storyboard.
Yeah.
That's neat.
Not even that. It's more like it's what they call a pitch.
Okay.
You've only got 15 minutes with this guy while he's ordering his, salad. And you just got to get through real quick. Boat Island 8. Can you see it?
Yeah.
Boat Island 8.
Yeah. But this piece, I think, is so amazing in terms of the scale that it has in that space. It's just dramatic and powerful and pow. I'm in love with this work. I think
what
it's
about
brilliant.
When it talks to you?
Oh, the sound effects.
Yeah. Well, this piece exists because Opping wanted it. And I was inclined to go along with most of his wishes, and which is, he picked this out, and I wouldn't have picked it out, but I'm really glad it got picked because then I had to redo it, and because it was the first time I did it, it was only about 3 feet tall, which is it's kind of like that scene in Spinal Tap when they bring out Stonehenge,
So you never answered about the sound effects.
Oh, I think they're extremely cool.
You talked earlier about images in a painting or in a sparking, and I'm wondering in the retrospective when you see all the work together, do you see sparks between individual pieces?
Well, there, yeah, I mean, actually, I noticed this when Fran and I were working on the book, and I'm going through all my transparencies, picking out which pieces are going to be reproduced in the book. And I had always berated myself for the work not kind of hanging together, like all over the place, too many moments of desperation, And reassured in a way that there was something that kind of connected things up even through that many years. So I guess relieved is a word I would use there.
Yeah. Well, there are also images that from images of Nancy that are all over at almost every room, it seems like. And there's Mickey Mouse is a strong image that appears throughout. And Vernon told me once that he uses images from his archive in the way that a writer uses words. That is, just because you've used the word "the" once, you don't have to throw it away and never use it again. So they, you know, they have a sort of syntactical quality depending on where they are and the context they're in. They're like a word in a sentence. I thought that was really smart. It was very, wasn't something that you can't, I don't think you said, I'm going to use images like words in a sentence. But it was, it makes really good sense.
Well, there was a justification for, like, if I'm going to reference the sublime by using a landscape, well, why would I need to use a different landscape each time?
Right.
You know?
That's good.
White back there?
You. I can't.
As she said, you've got several different motifs running through your work. I was wondering if you could speak a little bit more about your motif with the jungle and with Heart of Darkness and with the whole African motif. We haven't heard a lot about that compared to Mickey Mouse and some others.
And then you'll put up the painting?
Yeah, out of Africa. I mean, we didn't pick out of Africa, but I know which one we got. You want private Africa, or do you want the out of Africa? Well, we got out of Africa. That's the better one to use for this discussion. This is out of Africa from 07, from 2007.
Okay. I mean, the Heart of Darkness business didn't come first, although I have an earlier piece named Heart of Darkness. It was because I really liked the title. But it did occur to me in doing these paintings based on a map of colonial Africa. And when I say colonial, I'm talking about Africa that is literally owned by European countries. Belgium, France, Britain, Germany had basically divided up Africa. What I was interested in was the notion of projecting our own dark side onto something that accepts that because we know so little about it, okay? So it's the same kind of projection that Conrad is sort of doing in Heart of Darkness, and it's a kind of like where you attribute to a continent that part of yourself that you don't want to acknowledge in yourself. You know, it's like all these Republicans, senators that end up, you know, railing against gay rights, and then they turn out to get caught. You know, it's that kind of projection.
That's all?
Well, I don't want to, you know.
Okay.
But I think most people get that if they look at it.
Yeah, and this one's also about Tarzan movies.
Well, Tarzan, you know, you think about
Harry
Tarzan.
Parker.
I mean, yeah, Tarzan, he's Rousseau natural man. You know, he's the natural man uncorrupted by civilization. So that's another myth, you know. And then if you look at all the extras in those Tarzan movies, they're also racist. You know, it's the Hollywood version of the primitive and so forth, you know. Mm-hmm. And, you know, like President Obama, when he talked about Heart of Darkness, he talked about it as a racist text.
It can be certainly read that way.
Yeah.
Any other questions? Yeah.
Can you talk a little bit about the stick paintings? The stick painting with the shells?
Oh, that's a stick chart. That's just an enlarged version of a stick chart, which was used in the Marshall Islanders made maps out of branches and cowrie shells. And they would carry them in their canoes, and they would be about so big, and that would be a map that they could use because it would have prevailing currents, where islands were, and location of islands, and so forth. So it was essentially a map. The story itself has to do with, as you know, a kind of quest for location. So that's how that connection got there.
Okay, let's take her. She's been having a little
okay.
I just have a question sort of related to your teaching experiences. Do you think it's possible to teach someone creativity or to help them to learn how to find new and interesting or new ideas?
Did everybody hear the question? She wanted to know, is it possible to teach someone creativity, to teach someone how to find new and original ideas? I don't. I think what you do is you can permit those kinds of things to happen, and you might be able to create a situation that encourages those things to happen. And but most of the stuff you're going to do as a teacher is probably going to have just the opposite effect, you know, because of the natural position of power that the teacher has in relationship to the student who wants the grade in that situation. If you could find a way to have a teaching relationship with no grades, then I think that might be more possible.
Okay, good deal. Thanks, everybody.